Junior Afternoon, made possible with support from Sentinel Coffee, serving Southeast Alaska with locally roasted organic coffee and door-to-door delivery. More at sentinelcoffee.com. Our next guest is here to preview tonight's fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It's Karen Blavis. Karen, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about what you're going to be talking about, which I'm so interested in. I love this title. The title of your lecture is Love, Eat, Sleep, What Bats Do After Their Pups Leave Home. So do bats love?
They sure do.
It's a philosophical question, I guess, a big one to start off with. But, well, first of all, you're a bat biologist. Is that correct? Or what is your how would you describe your title?
I'm the diversity biologist for Fish and Game's Threatened, Endangered, and Diversity Program.
Okay.
So I work here in Southeast Alaska. And so I study things that aren't hunted or trapped, basically.
I see.
So
okay.
Birds, small mammals, bats.
Okay. And diversity is an interesting way to title that. What's behind that name of diversity?
We went round and round. We used to be the non-game program.
I see.
But nobody liked being, you know,
non-game.
Defined by a non. So
okay,
we switched to diversity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's all the little creatures that are around, a huge part of what makes this place our home and what we love to observe every day.
Exactly.
They just don't happen to be game species.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. So bats, wow, it's so fascinating. And I was just talking to you. A friend of mine, Jen Karnick, actually worked for you for a while doing some of the research that you've done on bats. And when she was doing it, it just was another fascinating thing every time I talked to her about what she was doing. She was doing mist netting. So tell me a little bit about kind of when you're studying bats, what are some of the steps you have to take to be able to study them and to observe them?
Yeah. So when we first started the project, we knew so little that we started out by taking detectors and walking all the trails in Juneau to see where we would hear them. And so once we found these kind of hot spots, we would put stationary detectors out there and or we would trap bats there.
And you're listening for ultrasonic sounds?
Yeah, we're listening for their echolocation calls.
Yeah,
and
right.
These detectors have special ultrasonic microphones. And so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's cool. And our little brown bats, is that the main ones? Or what are the ones we're talking about,
that
species that are here?
That's the most common
okay.
species in Alaska. It's the only one that's found outside of Southeast Alaska. But we do have other species here. We have Keene's myotis. We have California myotis, silver-haired bat. Possibly long-legged myotis, but we haven't ever trapped any of those. So.
And the one thing I know that people have been talking about a lot recently about bats is there's a fungus or there's some sort of a – is it a white nose disease or something that's going on with them?
Exactly. It's called white nose syndrome.
Okay.
And it's named because the fungus looks like a little, you know, white spot on their noses when the bats are hibernating.
And has that hit here as well?
It hasn't. It has killed millions, well over 6 million bats in the east and Midwest, and it did pop up in western Washington. But that was actually a main impetus for studying bats. And it's really an open question what's going to happen with white nose in the West, and that's because the hibernation behavior is so different. So once you get west of the Rocky Mountains, you don't find bats hibernating in caves and mines like you do back east. And so a big part of our early research was to figure out where our bats are going in the wintertime and what kinds of structures they're using for hibernation. And that's probably been the biggest obstacle to figuring out like how quickly white nose is going to spread and whether it's going to have the same level of severity in terms of impacts on western bat populations that it
yeah.
had back east.
So what did you find? I mean, where I would have assumed they'd be all in those old abandoned mines and
well,
in caves
that's what
and
I assumed
stuff.
When
yeah.
I started out, but after talking to cavers, I realized they weren't finding any in there. So we did a radio telemetry study and we basically flew around at sunset, circling over where the bats had roosted during the day, waiting for one to make a move. And then we followed it in real time to where it stopped moving. And then we'd follow up on the ground and track in on it. And basically, most of them are roosting. They're literally holing up for the winter. So we found them in on these really steep, forested, rock-scree slopes. So they're just under the soil layer. It's just a jumble of rocks under there, and they're just crawling into, you know, all the interstitial
spaces. Just
the
little cracks and
yeah.
Yeah, crevices like where you might see a marmot crawl out of or something or
– Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right,
no,
yeah.
And then there were actually a couple that were under the root systems of trees or stumps.
So, wow, that's fascinating. Yeah. Because, yeah, you'd think there'd be plenty of caves and things like that for them to
well, there
find
are.
Here. Yeah.
And it's interesting. So it makes me think that actually caves are suboptimal habitat because when given a choice, they don't seem to use them in the West.
Hmm. Yeah.
So –
And that's throughout the West.
That's throughout the West. There's only one species, Townsend's big-eared bats, that regularly hibernates in caves or mines.
Huh. Well, that's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it? I mean, it must be for bat biologists as well. Like, that's an interesting –
It took a long time to convince the Eastern bat biologists. They really thought we were crazy when we told them that our little browns were not hibernating in caves and mines.
Right.
They thought we were crazy.
Now, do they still fully hibernate, though? They're really –
They do.
They're, yeah.
They do. They're hibernating for at least half the – year.
And when they, you know, I've talked to bear biologists and they say, you know, bear hibernation, they sort of always make air quotes because bears are sometimes in deep sleep, but a lot of times not. And they even are giving birth and all that kind of stuff is happening while they're denning. What's a bat hibernation look like?
Well, bats do arouse periodically throughout the winter. It's a little hard to study them in the West because they're not accessible. Like in the East, you can walk into the cave or the mine, kind of pick the bat off the wall and do all sorts of things with it.
Right.
So they can put data loggers and all sorts of things on them. But we can't really do that here. So we don't know if the patterns are the same. But back East, they arouse every couple, 2-3 weeks. And then they just go back, you know, down into deep torpor again.
Yeah, interesting. Now, your lecture tonight is it sort of specifically about once bats have given birth, what they do? Is that right, or is it?
So this talk was inspired by an accidental discovery that we made 2 summers ago. You know, we've been monitoring the hibernacula that we did find with trail cameras and detectors, trying to see if they were reusing those sites. And because bats hibernate starting in early September, we'd go out in late August and early September and put the equipment out, and then pull it in the spring. Well, in the summer of 2017, we left the equipment out all summer just to see what else was using the area. And we checked it in late July, and there were over 150 videos of bats. And so it turns out that bats are swarming at these sites. And swarming is a behavior that they commonly observe at caves and mines back East that bats use for hibernation. And it's basically a bunch of bats circling around at the entrance and going in and out of the entrance of the cave. And it's believed to be associated with mating and also, you know, assessing whether a site is suitable for hibernation, especially for young bats.
Yeah, right. And so how does that figure in with what happens when the pups leave home and all that? That's happening at a certain time once the pups are out?
So the pups, they're able to fly sometime in July or August.
How old would they be at that point?
So it's 3 weeks.
They can fly at 3 weeks?
They can fly at 3 weeks.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing. So
probably and are
not
they
very,
tiny
not
still?
Very good. They're definitely smaller than adults.
But still, like
the adults are small to begin with. So
a layman observer probably wouldn't be able to necessarily tell.
At the time they start flying, you would. They are significantly
small. Yeah,
smaller.
That's cool to think about. But they're not very good at it, you say?
Not when they first emerge. So, and, you know, that's why we find a lot of dead bats in July and August.
Sure.
And a lot of those are young of the year that just are having head issues.
Yeah, couldn't figure it out quite. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, once the pup is independent, then the female can leave the maternity roost and go off and do other things like
before they leave. I just want to ask one quick question. Before they leave the maternity roost, as you say, are they very attentive mothers? How are they mothering?
So the females will roost communally in warm places so that they can speed the development of their pup, and they'll nurse the pup. There have been some reports of other females at nursing pups that aren't their own.
It's like put them all in a daycare center, kind of, right? It's like a little area.
I mean, usually they nurse their own.
Sure, but still, it's.
But they're all grouped together.
They work as a group.
Yeah, well, there's some benefits. It increases the heat.
Sure.
You know, all that body heat adds up, and so.
But it's just interesting because the way you were describing the way they hibernate, they don't hibernate in these mass groups the way that other bats do. So they are kind of forming little groups in order to do this maternal roost. Is that right?
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
The males, they're always roosting kind of singly or maybe in small groups, and the non-reproductive females as well. But those reproductive females, they can form really big groups, like, you know, over 1,000 bats, for example.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And then so when they – so then they take off and after they leave that maternal roost is where I interrupted you there.
Yeah. So most of our maternity roosts are in buildings and usually in the furnace room or attic, you know, nice warm space. And most of them are in the Mendenhall Valley. So once they leave there, they tend to kind of cluster in a few areas, like the northern end of the valley, kind of closest to the glacier, or around Fish Creek Pond is another big area. And so then they're roosting singly in homes, and they may just be tucked up under a shingle or, you know, just, under any loose, you know, piece of roofing or whatever, or in snags or trees. And so we kind of were interested, you know, we had radio tagged a bunch of bats trying to figure out where they went in the winter, but we used these data loggers. We'd put them out where the bats were roosting, so it would pick up the signal when the bat was there, and it wouldn't when the bat left. So we would know if a bat left, when it left, how long it stayed, and when it returned. And, you know, we kind of assumed that they were spending a lot of time eating to get fat for the fall.
Right.
Well, it turns out they don't get fat for the fall. Their weights hardly change at all over the course of the season, which is really unusual and really interesting.
Huh.
So
how do they do it through the winter? And
so I think that they must be roosting at close to an optimal temperature so that
not burning a lot of excess energy. Yeah,
yeah. The roosts aren't getting too cold, so they don't have to, you know, raise their metabolism to stay warm. Or
well, Karen, this is fascinating, and I could talk about this for two more hours. But fortunately, you're going to be giving a lecture tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. That's two lectures, one at 6:30 and one at 8 o'clock. You're teaming up with Tori Rhodes, who's also going to be doing that as well with you.
So Tori's been involved in all this work. She won't be able to join me on the podium tonight.
Oh, she's not able to join. Okay, great. And then, but she's been involved in the work. And again, it's Love, Eat, Sleep, What Bats Do After Their Pups Leave Home with Karen Blavis. Karen, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know a little bit more about all the little amazing bats that inhabit Juneau. Thank you so much. Coming up right now, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. A flock of geese wings across the sky in perfect V-shaped formation. It's one of the most enduring images of migration. Step outside.